This is Zorba Pastor on Your Health. Tom Clark here with Family Doc Zorba Pastor. Zorba through the hour, talking with you about what's new in healthy living, sharing some down-to-earth advice and some great lifestyle tips to help you get the most out of life. Do you have a question for Zorba? It's a great time right now to give us a call at 800-462-7413. Now, along with your calls, always some interesting research, Zorba.
Yes, we're going to talk about Chicago cops shaping up or shipping out, whether or not fat that you have in your body should be a determination of whether or not you keep your job.
Oh, interesting. And?
Crestor, Vitorin, statin drugs, Zocor, Lipitor. What's on the horizon? What's happening? How do you make sense out of all this sort of mucky news that's going on?
And it is back in the news. Our recipe this time.
Honey poached pears. This is a low cholesterol recipe. There's no cholesterol in honey. There's no cholesterol in pears. It's a great dessert.
Coming up, our medical Mythbuster later on in the hour has to do with twins. You'll want to stay tuned for that. Zorba, to the phones we go, and a listener in Buffalo, New York. Hi.
Hey, guys. Thanks for having me on.
We appreciate the call. How can we help?
Well, about 4 weeks ago, I started having some fairly serious feeling pain in my chest, and it goes back and forth between my chest and my back near my sternum. So about 3 weeks ago, I went to a doctor and was diagnosed with costochondritis and was prescribed basically aspirin with codeine, which helps me sleep for about 3 hours at night. During the day, it's not that bad if I stand ramrod or sit ramrod straight, which has been good for my posture. But sleeping at night is very, very uncomfortable, and just the codeine and the aspirin gets me again about 3 hours. So I'm wondering if there's any, you know, whether I should ice it or heat it or any other kind of medicines I should ask about just to control the pain again, particularly at night, so I can sleep.
First of all, Zorba, what's costochondritis?
Well, we've got joints all over our body, and one of the joints we have is our sternum, which is our breastbone, and the ribs, and they articulate together. You've got ribs that are pushing on the center bone, and you can have pain in there, and that's basically what it is. It's pain at that joint in there. So how'd you get it? Sometimes it happens spontaneously, sometimes with an injury. What'd you do?
Yeah, it was spontaneous. I hadn't fallen. I had, you know, nothing was going on unusual. So, yeah, the doctor says sometimes it just happens spontaneously, and that seems to have been what happened to me.
That's exactly what happens. It can just be a spontaneous thing that happens. Did you get injected at all?
No.
By the way, that's one treatment. One treatment is you inject with some steroid and some xylocaine or something called Marcaine, which is just like xylocaine, and you inject essentially right into the point where it's pain. And sometimes that can produce dramatic relief in some people. So that's one thing I would consider. Taking a painkiller such as codeine. Codeine, I tend to stay away from. It tends to be more constipating than hydrocodone. But codeine is certainly okay to take. And one of the other things you can do is you can wrap yourself in an elastic bandage at night when you're going to sleep. And, you know, by doing that, it can't be too tight, but just puts a little bit of pressure over there, and sometimes that helps.
Terrific.
What kind of pillows do you have in your bed?
Big fluffy one. It's firm. It's a firm pillow.
It's a firm pillow.
Yeah.
Sometimes also, if you get like other little pillows, you may have throw pillows around the house, or you go to a department store and you get these small little pillows. They're called travel pillows. They sell them all over the place. They're really tiny, and you sort of pillow your body so that, you know, you've got pillows all over when you're bending and twisting. That and a little ACE wrap and warm milk before you go to sleep. You know,
I've been taking scotch.
Warm.
Forget the milk.
Forget the milk. The scotch works just fine. That's in a glass of scotch. Well, thanks for your call.
But before you go, how long have you had this?
About a month now.
Is this the sort of thing, Zorba, which will kind of go away on its own over time?
It tends to go away on its own. You know, unless you drink that scotch and fall over and re-injure
yourself.
Don't
do that.
Terrific. Thank you very much.
Sure, we appreciate the call. Bye-bye. 800-462-7413.
I mean, here I am in my puritanical mode saying warm milk. He says, no, I'm taking scotch. Alcohol can also help.
But haven't we talked about the fact that scotch really isn't any good at night for helping one relax and go to sleep?
Yes, alcohol tends to be disturbing to sleep. But you know what? You got a little pain in your chest. You're sitting down late at night, taking some codeine. You don't feel so good. Hey, Warm milk would be my recommendation, but some people follow their own path.
800-426-2743. Our path takes us next to a listener in St. Louis, Missouri. Hi.
Hi.
What's up?
Oh, I am a loyal listener and thrilled to talk to you.
Oh, the thrill is all ours. How can we help?
I am a dance teacher. I also have to take calcium. I'm senior age, and I have to take Fosamax. I take calcium, a 600 milligram twice a day, along with my weekly Fosamax. They are also included, have some D in them. My problem is the calcium does cause some constipation, so consequently I try to regulate that with using a natural fiber, eating lots of fruits and vegetables, but I was heard on another program from a doctor that magnesium counters the calcium constipation problem. My question is, but how much? I think they said how much magnesium. I didn't catch that, and I was wondering if you would have an answer.
Well, there are a couple of things. First of all, magnesium, what they're talking about is magnesium in magnesium hydroxide, which is, when you look at magnesium products, milk of magnesia is a magnesium product.
Mm-hmm.
And so if you take enough milk of magnesia, you will alter your constipation from it.
Mm-hmm.
And that's basically what they were talking about. But getting back to the calcium issue, there's calcium citrate, there's calcium carbonate. I would try different kinds of calcium and see if one of them is less constipating for you. They're not all the same.
Oh, really?
Yeah, carbonate, which is the most common, tends to be more constipating for a lot of people. Citrate, which is not as commonly used, is less common. Go to the pharmacy, go to the drugstore, talk to the druggist and say, show me your different kinds of calcium. But there's citrate and carbonate, and I would try different preparations.
Mm-hmm.
Second, you don't have to have the D in with the calcium. You can take D separately. And I am now recommending 1,000 units of D. And if you look at the calcium plus D pills, if you take two pills a day, you're only getting about 400 units in most pills. And I recommend 1,000 units for a very important reason. There was a study a couple of years ago out of Nebraska. Third of the women took calcium plus D. Third of the women only calcium. Third of the women regular care. Looked at fractures 4 years down the line. Not that much of a difference between the groups. You'd expect a little difference in the calcium plus D and the calcium versus the placebo. But there was a difference in the cancer groups. And it appears that vitamin D taken at a level for people who are vitamin D deficient may cut the cancer rate by 10 to 20%. It's a biggie. I think it's a very major study. So I am putting people on 1,000 units of D as a supplement that I recommend. So I take 1,000 of D, try a different calcium product, and then if that doesn't work, what I would do is I would simply look at a stool softener or, like you're doing, fruits and vegetables, natural vegetable fiber. That might work too. And and bran cereal in the morning. And, constipation is a big issue when you start taking pills.
Yes. When you take fiber, I was told that you should not take fiber with supplements, that it kind of counters their absorption.
Yeah, not at all. You can certainly take fiber with supplements. So, the concept that you have to take a supplement on an empty stomach, I don't think there's any evidence that you really have to do it. If you look at what supplements are, they're supplementing food, right?
Mm-hmm.
They're from food.
Right.
Well, we don't take food on an empty stomach because it's food. And good food that will have a supplement will often have fiber. So Mother Nature puts fiber and supplements together with food. And I like to follow what Mother Nature's plan is, and she puts it all together. So, yes.
Fiber,
supplements.
Things all mix well together.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Yay.
So, there you go.
Thank you so very much.
Well, thank you so much.
We appreciate the call. Thanks a lot for calling. Back to vitamin D for a second, Zorba. We don't talk enough, I think, about vitamin D. That's a very, very, very important part.
Oh, it is. Well, I'll tell you a few things. First of all, you live in the northern climate. You don't get enough vitamin D for probably half the year because you're not outside and the sun is too low in the horizon, actually, to give you enough solar energy to produce vitamin D. But I think vitamin D is a much, it's a vitamin that isn't sexy. For some reason,
yeah.
E is sexy, C is sexy,
yeah.
D has no sex involved. So
yeah.
So nobody talks about D. We're vitamin D deficient. especially adults, especially people in nursing homes, they're all vitamin D deficient.
And I don't know if there's any research on this, but I take vitamin D, and I think it's a mood enhancer as well. You can
tell. You notice the difference?
But the new cheery, positive.
You know, for months, I've been trying to figure out, why are you laughing and smiling and saying it's the new Tom Clark? It's vitamin D as the mood enhancer. I love it.
800-462-7413. I used to be a curmudgeon.
That's right.
You remember
That's changed. You're Mr. Happy, Mr. Smiley Face.
800-462-7413. So, the chief of police in Chicago is telling the cops now to shape up or ship out?
That's right. Very interesting. You know, it's quite often that when you get into a police force anywhere in the country, you've got to go through a fitness test. It's pretty common.
Oh, sure.
But once you're in the force, you're kind of there. And, you know, the typical thing that you see in police forces, you know, I mean, let's look the cop and the donut, right?
Sure,
you know,
of course, at the donut shop, yeah.
In peace. But the police department in Chicago, they're looking at whether or not they actually should continue to give certain fitness examinations. And if you don't meet the fitness examination, you're out. And one of the examinations is body fat allowance. In other words, the concept that if you're too fat, you can't be on the police force. Well, what does that mean? Is that fair? It's a society issue. It's kind of a fascinating thing.
On the other hand, it's a really interesting issue. On the one hand, it could be that if you're overweight, you wouldn't be able to perform effectively as a police officer. But it could also be that an overweight police officer might be a whole lot better than a normal, regular-sized police officer.
Right. I mean, you have to look at it from the point of view of the job. How much does it affect the job? Certainly, if you're overweight, you may not be able to run quickly as much, but that doesn't mean you can't do the other jobs that you do as a policeman. So, you know, I think this is a society issue more than everything else. I mean, should you have IQ tests before you work at public radio? You know, it's kind of interesting.
I'd vote against that. I want to keep my job.
Sorry, it's continuous IQ tests. Every year you get one. You don't score high enough. You are out of public radio.
But on the police thing, on the overweight thing, I mean, there could be overweight cops that can run faster than not overweight cops.
And it could be overweight cops. And it's not just running. We have this image because of television of policemen running all the time. The fact is they use their brains all the time, and that they use far more of that and perceived force than actual force.
I don't know where I am on this issue.
Well, I know where I am. I think the issue has to be looked at in a broader way. I think you have to have extremes. You know, if you are 350-pound disabled, you can't walk policeman, should you be on the beat? That's one issue. That's one extreme.
Well, right. The answer to that is
right.
Obvious.
That's one extreme.
Yeah.
But I think for a physical job, just like firemen and policemen, you have to have some minimal requirements.
They should do regular testing.
Well, they're not talking about minimal requirements. They're talking about the amount of fat on your body.
Yeah.
Not can you run, but how much fat do you have? That's a different issue.
It seems to me they shouldn't do that. They should do regular testing through the years of cops to make sure they can do whatever the duties are that they have to do.
But then the question is, here it is, you're a good policeman, you've done a good job, you've been on the force for 10 or 15 or 20 years, you know how to handle certain situations, maybe far better than a rookie, but you're fat and the rookie is thin. Who do you want protecting you?
Well, obviously you want the one that can do the best job.
Right. Well, as you can see, there's no simple answer to that, is there? Yeah. I mean, I don't know which one I would choose, but I wouldn't say automatically I'm going to choose the rookie.
Right.
Because the rookie is fit. I don't think that would be it. I'd look at the job, look at the situation, and make the decision. Yeah. Yeah. But I don't think people should be taken off their position because of body fat. I don't think that's a good idea. Fitness is one thing. Body fat is a totally different issue.
1-800-462-7413. Toll free. Caller on the line. A line open for you at 800-462-7413. To Brooklyn, Wisconsin we go now. Hi.
Good day, guys. Nice to hear from you.
Yeah. What can we do for you?
Well, I have a question that has come up a number of times in my life, being that I am a redhead and very fair-skinned, some would say pale. Mm-hmm. I sunburn very easily.
Well, you're in the right state, Wisconsin. You don't have to worry about sun very much.
Yeah, heading south is a problem for me.
Yeah,
Yeah, I can get a good sunburn going in about 15 minutes.
Oh.
And my whole family is like this. I unfortunately married a nice pale white-skinned woman and have very pasty children as well, so we're all in the same boat.
Mm-hmm.
And My question comes down to this. Is it the amount of time that I'm in the sun that's a problem, or would it be the same for someone else? If I go outside with a nice swarthy Italian friend of mine and we both don't have sunscreen on, are we at the same risk for skin cancers and other things, or am I, as the lighter-skinned person, at a higher risk?
You are at a higher risk.
I am.
Yes, you are. That is right. You are at a higher risk. And it's interesting. If we look at the highest incidence of melanoma in the world, the highest incidence of melanoma happens to be in Australia. Among the Australians who get a lot of sun, they get more sun than we do. There's just more sun where they live and the way the continent works. And they have the highest risk in the world. And when they started working on melanoma reduction about 30 years ago, and they've done a tremendous job of educating Aussies to wear sunscreen and so on and stop getting suntans, they made a big difference. And they discovered in those studies, among other studies, that people who were more likely to burn were at a higher risk, because one of the major risks for basal cell carcinoma and melanoma, which is the skin cancer that can kill you caused from the sun, is burning. And so you burn more easily than a swarthy skinned Italian, and so you are at more risk. That's just the way it is. You're at a higher risk for sunscreen and sun damage, wrinkling of the skin, and the other issues associated with it. And it's a genetic issue. And they're at less risk, but they're not at no risk. And the same is true of African Americans. They're at a less risk for burning and less risk of melanoma, but they're not at a zero risk for melanoma and so on. So yes, it's more important for you to wear sunscreen than it is for your swarthy Italian friend.
Okay, I had always just assumed that it was the amount of time you were in the sun, no matter who you were.
Well, the amount of time counts, but because you're at a higher risk for burning, you really are at a higher risk for the complications of burning. It really is. They really are both things together. Now, what do you do when you actually go out in the sun? Do you wear sunscreen that often, or?
Yeah, I usually try to. I've found that I'm really bad when it's overcast out, and I'll go out. Seems nice and overcast, but I still get a good sunburn in a half hour.
Right, so it really makes a difference. One of the things I'm now recommending to people who are wearing sunscreen is find one that is aesthetically pleasing. So there are differences basically not just in what's in the sunscreen, such as whether it has PABA or Parasol 1786. I can never remember the number of the other product, which protects you from A and B. But also there are lotions, creams, and gels. And basically find one that you find aesthetically pleasing and then put it all over in your car, in a briefcase, in a small container here, in a tube. So when you find yourself, getting burned, or I forgot the sunscreen at home, you didn't forget it at home. It's in the car. It's in the briefcase. It's in the backpack. And
okay,
I think that's a tip.
We keep a kid size one in the diaper bag.
There you go.
How old
is your son?
Is 4. My daughter is 18 months.
Oh, how cool is that?
Wow. Yeah, and he loves being outside, so he always has to be slathered up with something 50 SPF or over.
There you got it. Exactly. So
that's on the rare occasions when the sun shines in Wisconsin.
Yeah.
Thanks a lot for the call.
Thanks, guys.
Remember Zorba, when our producer Adam Friedrich came back from Texas not that long ago?
Yes.
Burned from head.
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah.
From head to toe, because he was in sunny weather and he didn't know how to handle it.
Exactly.
The sun was out and he just was not really sure what to do, and he didn't realize you wear sunscreen in the sun. That's exactly it.
Well, speaking of sun, Zorba, let's see if we can help out Katie from Jacksonville, Florida, where she has a lot of sun, of course. She'd like to know if there's any way to increase the amount of breast milk a mother produces.
Well, there are a number of things you can do. First of all, hydration is very important for breast milk. So making sure that you're hydrated is of key importance. That's the issue. Making sure that you eat a well and nutritious diet makes a difference. You have to have enough protein, because you're producing protein and you're producing carbohydrates in breast milk. So making sure that you eat a diet that has enough calories and enough protein is really very important. And then a lot of people say rest. Trying to get within the day, trying to be off your legs if you're not even sleeping, but resting for 8 hours a day. And as a mom who's breastfeeding often, you're not necessarily going to get 8 hours in a row, may get 8 hours through the day, but a lot believe that. One of my best recommendations is you go to La Leche. The La Leche League is excellent for a variety of information concerning breast milk. And we'll put a link to that on our website, because breastfeeding is really so important. And their classic book that came out 30 years ago, The Womanly Art of Breastfeeding, well, it was a book from the 30s that really had a resurgence in the 70s, I think is just a classic. So we'll put the link in there. So
we like hearing from you. Send us your comments, questions, and tips in an email to
Zorba@WPR.org.
Honey poached pears.
Good.
That's our recipe coming up next here on Zorba Pastor on Your Health from PRI, Public Radio International. Tom Clark with Family Doc Zorba Pastor here on Zorba Pastor on Your Health. That toll-free number again is 800-462-7413. Right now, though, recipe time. And Zorba, you've been coasting a lot lately with listener-supplied recipes. This one is from the kitchen of Zorba Pastor. Honey poached pears.
That's right. It's a dessert recipe. You know, we all deserve dessert, don't you think, Tom?
Oh, yeah.
You know, dessert before the main meal, dessert before the appetizer.
Oh, no, I wouldn't. No,
you wouldn't
never.
Say that. It has to be the right order.
My mother would never eat dessert before the main.
Appetizer, soup, salad, the main course. You eat that way every night, right? A couple of side dishes.
I've never eaten appetizers. I have food, and then I have dessert.
And then you have dessert.
Just like most people.
That's right.
Appetizer.
That's right. Or in America, some people have dessert without food. But anyway, this is a healthy dessert. We use honey, of course, which is a wonderful natural product. We use pears, which are great. Mm-hmm. You know, we can get pears any time of year. And when you poach them, you can actually take pears that are not, if you will, spring and summer pears that are going to be a little bit tastier and make them tastier. So I like this recipe.
Honey poached pears.
That's right. Start out with two large pears, ripe, halved, and cored. And you're going to cut each half into 6-inch wedges. So you're going to wedge those pears.
Two large pears, ripe, halved, cored, and then cut into 6 wedges.
That's right. Now, you can really use any pear. You can use a Bosque pear for this, or you can use any sort of another pear. Just like apples, they're different pears. They have different textures and tastes. So pick a pear you like. Mm-hmm. Do you like pears?
Yeah, I like pears.
You like pears? Yeah,
I don't eat as many as I could eat more pears.
You could
like
eat more pears.
Yeah.
Why don't you put pears in your diet? You know, the Pear Council hasn't gotten up to you yet telling you, it's another list.
Pears on the shopping
list. That's right,
on the shopping list.
That's right. 4 tablespoonfuls of honey.
4 big tea honey.
That's right. Pick the honey of your choice. 1 tablespoonful of white wine.
We all pick the honeys of our choices.
Yes, we do. Yes, we do. I lobbed that to you, and you hit that as a home run, didn't you?
Okay. 4 big tea honey.
1 tablespoonful of white wine.
Big tea of white wine.
Gotta love it. You know, I'm so glad you took that vitamin D. You just don't have that curmudgeon attitude anymore. It's all joy.
Okay.
It's no cynicism.
Yeah.
4 teaspoons of dried cranberries.
4 little tea dried cranberries.
That's right. Craisins. A lot of times they're called craisins. They're basically like raisins, which are a dried grape, and this is dried cranberries.
We have the recipe in front of us. I hadn't looked at the ingredients.
Right,
I thought those were raisins in there, but they're not.
They're dried cranberries.
Okay.
And, you know, one of the number one cranberry producers in the country happens to be?
Wisconsin.
That's right. Yeah. I think we're number one.
Yeah, we're number one.
We're number one. The state of cranberries, we call ourselves. Not just cheese, not just milk. 1 teaspoon of grated lemon peel.
A little tea grated lemon peel.
1/2 teaspoon ground cinnamon.
1/2 little tea ground cinnamon.
Use a good cinnamon. Don't go out and buy the cheap cinnamon. You can buy cheap cinnamon. Use that when you're going to have buttered toast and sprinkle cinnamon on there. buy a good cinnamon because it really does make a difference. You want it to be aromatic.
I would think it'd make a difference on the toast, too.
It would make a difference. Yeah. But the toast usually has sugar with it also. 1 tablespoonful of brown sugar.
1 big tea brown sugar.
1/2 cup low fat vanilla yogurt.
Oh, that's what the white stuff is in.
That's right.
1/2 cup of low fat vanilla yogurt.
That's right. So let's make the recipe. Mm-hmm. Preheat the oven to 400 degrees. Now, place a large baking sheet in the oven, heat it up. Now, Take 4 sheets of tin foil, about 12 inches long, and place the foil on a nice working surface. Arrange 6 pear wedges, 1/2 on the foil. Drizzle with a tablespoonful of honey, 1/4 teaspoon of the wine. Sprinkle with a teaspoon of the dried cranberries and 1/4 teaspoon of the lemon peel, pinch of cinnamon, 1/4 tablespoonful of brown sugar, and a pinch of nutmeg. So in other words, you're preparing each of these wedges. Now, fold the foil sheet in half, sealing the arrangement completely. You're really making a little packet here together, and you're going to repeat that with the remaining 4 sheets. You've got 4 packets. Place the foil packets in the preheated oven on top of the preheated baking sheet and bake until the pears are tender. That's about 10 minutes. Allow it to cool completely. Open up the packets, put it over these 4 bowls, and top each with a dollop of yogurt and serve. Mm-hmm. And I can tell from your face that this is delicious.
Yeah. Well, you know, it is. It's very nice. You serve
like
this for dessert, and people will say, this is really something unusual. I would never think to put pears together with the yogurt. You can get a little taste of the wine in there.
This is delicious. Isn't it good?
Very good. We're happy to send you a copy of this recipe. Address your request to Zorba Pastor on Your Health, 821 University Avenue, Madison, Wisconsin, zip 53706. Don't forget to enclose a self-addressed stamped business-sized envelope.
Or you can go to our website at zorbapastor.org, and you can sign up for our podcast, which you can get every week if you wish it. And you can also go through the other fine recipes that we've got on the site.
Is our toll-free number. Question for Zorba? Call 1-800-462-7413. And Zorba, a listener with us now in Oklahoma City, Oklahoma. Hi.
Hello. How are you doing today?
Fine. How can we help you?
My question is about the preservatives in wine. Mm-hmm. I found that wine makes my nose stuffy, and I get very sleepy. Basically, when I've compared equivalent alcoholic content of drinks such as liquor, beer, liqueurs to wine, I found that beside the abnormal alcohol effect, the depressive effect, I normally get a very stuffy nose and very tired. A friend of mine had once suggested that it could be the sulfites that are normally added to wines as a preservative, and he had suggested that I try sulfite-free or organic wines. I understand that most wines, in the process that of fermentation, they make their own sulfites, but most makers will add more as preservatives. So over the last decade, I've noticed that when I usually take these organic wines, they I usually don't get as very tired as I do with a normal bottle of wine. And this has been going on for a long time. I was just wondering, is there medical support for this allergy or sensitivity, or is it just in my head?
Yeah, let me ask you how often you do this multiple taste test to find out the difference between wine. Is this a frequent thing? Have you been doing this for a long time?
Let's put it this way. I rarely drink. And but when I do, it's in a social setting, like a dinner setting or something. So what I'll do is, like, maybe one night we'll have drinks that have liquor in them, and other nights I'll have a glass of wine with the meal. And or, you know, maybe I'll have, like, a liqueur drink versus a wine with the meal. You know, just this has been a question that I've had over a long time, but I don't normally drink. I'm a teetotaler, definitely fits for me.
I get it. You haven't lined up the various kind of types of alcohol on the table and tried one after the other, time after time after time.
You know, if I did that, I don't think the sleepy effect would be because of me.
That's very good. That's very good. Very good. Getting back to sulfites, you're right. These are naturally produced products that happen during the fermentation process. But to standardize wines and to make sure that they remain drinkable, basically sulfites are added to preserve the wine. And that's just what they do in the commercial manufacturing of wine. So you have to find out whether or not there's, A, a type of wine that tends to make you Tends to make you stuffier. B, if there's really a difference, if it's an organic wine that makes a difference. White wine is different. Some people can tolerate white wine. They can't tolerate red wine. Other people find there's certain kinds of red wine, certain kinds of grapes they can tolerate and not other types of grapes. So I think I would shop around and look around. I don't think I would just say it's all wine. It may be all commercial wine, which tends to be about this probably the same level of sulfite. But it may be that when you go to the organic wines or wines where sulfites are not added, that indeed you won't have that reaction. But one wine might be different than another one. So you have to do it. It's hard, though. I bet you when you're at friends' houses and they have wine, it must be tough because, you know, they offer you some wine and you go, I'm sorry, I can't touch it. I'm going to be all stuffy and start to stuff up. Do you have trouble when you go out?
No, normally when wine comes out for like a dinner party with friends, I'll have like a glass. And I'm done. That either I have a second glass and I'm really falling asleep at the table, or you know, I just make that one last the whole night long.
Right, and that's kind of part of it. I've got a question for you. Do you like the taste of wine, or do you just like the ambiance of sitting there with the glass of wine and your friends?
It depends on the wine.
It depends on the wine. Okay, a wine connoisseur.
No, just some wines taste very bitter to me.
Oh.
While other wines, you know, because some people are like, oh, this has a great bouquet, and to me it tastes kind of metallic. And other wines are have a good fruit flavor to them.
My recommendation is find the wine that you like, and that's what you have. And then what you do is you bring it over to your friends' houses.
That's what I was just thinking, sure.
When you're having dinner, and you say, I've got this great wine, you've got to try it, and they don't even have to know why you're bringing it over.
All I have to do is ask what they're serving.
That's right.
Yeah.
There you go. There you go.
Appreciate the call.
Thanks, guys. I appreciate it.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Yeah. Do you like the taste of wine, Zorba?
Oh, I love wine. I love wine. It's small amounts. I mean, I drink wine 4 or 5 nights a week, a glass of wine.
I hardly ever.
No, I don't drink a lot, but I often come home and I have a little glass
of wine. I hardly ever drink wine, but I don't think I've ever had a glass of wine that I didn't think really tasted good.
Oh,
they all taste
that's
good
it.
To
How
me.
How about Ripple? Ripple Red and Ripple
White? Yeah, Ripple, whatever.
Boone Farm, you remember those days?
Some $10,000 bottle of wine to
that's
me
right, that was sweet. That's right. There you go. There you go. When you come over to our house, we're serving Ripple Red or Ripple White.
Do they still have that?
I don't really know, Tom. I'm not in the mood to shop. I tend not to put that in my basket.
I think you're
when
flashing back to college days. 800-462-7413. That's 1-800, and that's a long flashback.
Oh, it's a very long flashback. I can barely remember it.
7413. On to St. George, Utah now. Hi.
Hi, Tom. Hi, Zorba. How's it going?
Fine. What's up?
Yeah, my question is about 5-HTP, a serotonin supplement. And I'm considering taking its use, but I'm just concerned about if there are any side effects or contraindications to its use.
What are you thinking of taking it for? Why are you wanting to take it?
I have had anxiety since 9, and I'm doing pretty good now, but I think I should, you know, just to get along a little bit better, maybe have a little bit of supplementation.
To relieve the anxiety.
Yeah, well, I have to tell you something. I mean, serotonin is a 5-HT. I mean, it has a chemical structure. So they're naming the supplement after serotonin. And I don't know very much about it, but it doesn't mean it's going to increase your serotonin levels at all. But a couple of things for anxiety. What are you doing for your anxiety?
I went to a doctor and asked about an antidepressant, and he prescribed me a tricyclic amitriptyline, and I took it, and the next morning I woke up feeling like a zombie, and I said, okay, don't want to take that anymore. So then after that, I went to cognitive behavioral therapy, which has done wonders for me, but I think for me to move along a little bit faster at a pace that I'm comfortable with, I should consider taking 5-HTP, if that would be a good option.
I've got a very specific recommendation. Keep up with the cognitive behavioral therapy. Very good. And I would recommend St. John's Wort. That's what I would recommend. Very good for depression. It has a track record with anxiety. I know what its safety is. You can look at a consumer's report. I would choose that over the 5-HTP that you're looking at. St. John's Wort, that's my recommendation.
St. John's Wort. Yeah, I've heard of that.
That's right.
Yeah. Thanks so much for calling.
Mm-hmm. Thanks.
800-462-7413.
You know, when it comes to anxiety, I think there are two things that are important. Number one, you've got to find out, well, several things. You've got to find out what the anxiety is caused by. Cognitive behavioral therapy, knowing how the anxiety is put forth, can really make a difference in knowing how to handle it when it comes off. And then if you're looking for something natural, St. John's Wort, we know the pluses and the minuses. It's been well studied. I think that's a drug to go for, which if you're looking for a natural product versus something that's new and untried, 5-HTP, it's just an untried product. And you know, most of those things fall to the wayside because they don't work.
800-462-7413. And before our next call, Zorba, let's check in on the Zorba Pastor on Your Health inbox and take this email from Jane in Jacksonville, Florida. Jane writes, "Just wanted to let you know that I first caught your radio show by accident about a month ago, and since then have been listening on a regular basis. Also, I have a question about yucca. I began putting yucca into all my soups, and then I remembered that everything white turns into sugar in the body. Is this so? And if so, does yucca turn into sugar?"
Well, that's not so, and I have to tell you a story. I'm in high school. My mother said to me, she taught me since I was a young kid, everything that's liquid has water in it. I'm in chemistry class, and we're going over some liquid potion. I don't remember what it is. And I said to my chemistry teacher, "Why don't we just get rid of the water?" And he said, "There's no water in this." And I said, "Everything liquid contains water," at which point he and the rest of the class burst out laughing. I was totally embarrassed. Everything white, don't be embarrassed, does not turn into sugar. Look at chicken. Chicken's kind of white, doesn't turn into sugar. White does not mean sugar.
What's yucca?
A yucca is a vegetable. It's a plant product.
Oh, okay.
And it's a carbohydrate. Mm. So carbohydrates, though, when our body processes them, does turn into sugar. So
yucca,
you're right.
Yucca does go.
It becomes a carbohydrate. We process it. It does turn into sugar. But it's a complex carbohydrate, so it's good for you versus the simple carbohydrates of sugar. So you don't want to put them in the same class. You bet. The answer is the yucca really does become a carbohydrate, but it's got other value to it because it's more complex.
Well, it doesn't matter if you're a new listener or a longtime friend of the show. We'll take your questions, comments, and tips. Just send them in an email to
Zorba@WPR.org.
Some really interesting research coming up. We have our medical myth buster and more of your calls here on Zorba Pastor on Your Health from PRI, Public Radio International. Tom Clark with Family Doc Zorba Pastor here on Zorba Pastor on Your Health. Question for Zorba? A line open now at 800-462-7413. But, Zorba, before our next call, research, and I've got to say, as a non-medical type, I am totally confused now about cholesterol-lowering drugs, and my guess is that you guys in the medical community are totally confused about it, too, from what I've heard and
seen.
Well,
let's talk about what we know. First of all, we know that statin drugs, Zocor, which is simvastatin, Lescol, those are the name brands, Crestor and Lipitor, that have been used now, statin drugs, Mevacor, have been around for 20 years, you know, in different forms. We know that they lower the risk of heart attack and stroke, and we know that they save lives. That's what we know.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Now, so the issue is, could you make statins better? Or is one statin better than another? Lipitor came out with a big study that showed at the 80 milligram dose in patients with previous heart attacks, it reduced the risk of a second heart attack. They said, we're special. You can't prove it with the other drugs because they did a study that proved it, and the other studies just had never had it. Crestor, another drug, recently came out and showed that people who we normally would not put on statins, people with an elevated something called C-reactive protein, had a regression of plaque in their bodies. They didn't prove that they didn't have fewer heart attacks.
Right.
They showed the plaque shrunk. Once again, we don't know what that means, but we make an assumption that shrinking plaque is good. That remains to be seen. Vytorin was saying, wait a minute, we really lower HDL cholesterol, or rather increase HDL, we lower LDL, we're going to do a better job, we're going to make the plaque shrink, and it turned out that study did not show that at all. The plaque did not shrink.
Yeah, except nobody heard about that study for years.
That's the big issue. One of the issues is that the companies that actually produce that, that's Merck and Schering Plough, which own the patent to it, kept that data in-house for about 2 years. So 2 years ago, they had the data, and they said, well, we're working on the data, and they never showed that. That's a very separate issue. I think it's important. Once the data becomes available, you got to put it out to the medical community. Why didn't they put it out? I have no idea, except I can tell you the drug is a $5 billion a year drug. Money yeah. might have been involved with
you
that
think?
Decision.
You think? Yeah.
Certainly is a possibility. Now, the issue then is, does plaque reduction within or the thickness of the carotid artery, either reduction of plaque or thickness in the carotid artery, does that mean fewer heart attacks? And the answer is, we actually don't know that. So, in other words, that's the confusion. Even though Vytorin doesn't cause the shrinkage, Crestor does cause the shrinkage, what does that mean for the
heart attack? Here's what I've heard from the TV docs that you see on the news from the in their 30-second long things. Only use Vytorin now as a last resort. That makes no sense to me whatsoever.
No,
what
think,
is the last resort?
I think the answer is stay on your statin drug if you're on it, and if you're on Vytorin, you've got to discuss this with your doctor.
800-462-7413, our toll-free number. That's 800-462-7413. Zorba, we welcome a listener now in Riverton, Wyoming. Hi.
Hello.
What's up?
I have a question about rosacea. In January, I visited a dermatologist, a local dermatologist here, and he said that I have the classic symptoms of rosacea, and he gave me a prescription of antibiotics and basically told me to discontinue all use of creams, you know, anything, you know, facial or whatever, any of the over-the-counter. But he said the only thing you can use on your face is mineral oil and water. And so I tried his remedy, and after 10 days of being on the antibiotics, my internal organs, I felt like I was going to scratch myself to death. It just seemed like I was reacting to the antibiotics, and I just took the whole bottle of antibiotics and dumped them down the toilet, and I said, I can live with rosacea. It's worse than the cure. So I thought I would seek out other help as far as what is there homeopathic remedies that could help with rosacea. I'm looking for suggestions, I guess.
Well, a couple of suggestions. First of all, have you been on the topical antibiotic called Metrogel?
Nope.
Well, that's a very effective treatment for rosacea. In fact, that's the sort of the first-line treatment, not oral antibiotics. This is a topical antibiotic-like drug called Metrogel. That's the name brand. It comes in a variety of generics. And probably for half the people with rosacea, that works really, really well. You put it on once or twice a day. It does a great job. If that fails, often people then go on the oral antibiotics. But like you say, some people don't tolerate them. Now, when you said you felt like your insides were going to fall out, what do you mean? I mean,
well,
I mean, I understand it's a negative thing, but what do you mean? What kind of symptoms were you having?
Well, it felt like itching, and it felt like I was going to throw up.
Well, maybe there are two things. First of all, the commonly used antibiotics for rosacea can cause stomach pain and discomfort. So feeling like you're going to vomit probably was from that. And you might have been allergic to the antibiotic, the itching that you had all over. It sounds like you were allergic, intolerant, or allergic and intolerant to the antibiotic. But the topical use of Metrogel can be very, very useful for rosacea. As far as homeopathic remedies, there are a variety of remedies that you put on your skin. And for some people, they're very effective. I would go to a local cosmetician and talk to a local cosmetician. They deal with this all the time, especially a good cosmetics counter in a department store.
Right. Okay. Yep. And I've actually sought out a local cosmetician here. What I'm using now seems to be working better than anything else I've tried, but it's still not going away. So maybe this Metrogel would be the next step.
That would be my recommendation. Good luck, and thank you for your call.
Thank you.
Sure. Bye-bye. 800-462-7413, our toll-free number. Zorba, time for our medical myth buster now. Today's myth deals with identical twins. Although twins have a lot in common, including their DNA, Is it true that they have the same fingerprints?
Good question. Absolutely. You know, when we look at twins, we know that their DNA is completely indistinguishable. But we know when you look at two twins and you talk to them when they're older and they can talk, you know, there are differences. And over time, one might get a little heavier, one might get a little thinner. And the answer is their fingerprints are not identical. Their fingerprints are different. And the theory behind that, it's sort of nature versus nurture, is that there are certain things that bring out what are called the phenotype, your individual characteristics, that are really a function of your genes and your environment. And fingertips, the whorls, the swirls, the ridges, and the fingerprints are thought to be caused by a bunch of different things that occur in the wound. Basically, things like the nutrition that the baby actually gets, that's not identical. One often is a little bigger than another one. The blood pressure of the placenta or the baby, the position in the womb, the growth rate of the fingers at the end of the first trimester. All these things are thought to affect the difference. And the answer is you can tell fingerprint-wise one identical twin from another identical twin. There's slight differences in the way that they look, or rather slight comparisons, but they are different enough so that if one commits a crime, you can tell which one it did.
Yeah. I think I knew that, but what's really interesting is the reasoning or why this happens, the stuff that goes on
it's
in the wound.
It's that from the wound, from birth on, there's a difference. You know, one is higher in the wound, one is lower in the wound, one is bigger in the wound. There are differences from birth that are actually, they're not growing in the identical environment.
Yeah. Interesting. Are you interested in having Zorba bust your myth? Send it along in an email to
Zorba@WPR.org.
800-462-7413. It's toll free. And a Milwaukee listener joins in now. Hi.
Hi.
What's up?
Well, I've got something very interesting for you guys.
We'll be the judge of that. Go ahead.
I've got a bet going on with me and my friends. I don't drink all that often, and they drink a lot. Mm-hmm. And we just finished college not too long ago, and we've been arguing. I think binge drinking kills brain cells, and they don't.
And your friend binge drinkers don't.
Yes, exactly. They think they're just the smartest people on earth. And I actually received an email from one of my friends, and he sent me an article from Men's Health telling him that binge drinking is fine. You drink so much and you're going to be completely fine and that your brain's not going to be affected. And I there has to be more medical proof than the propaganda of Men's Health. I just don't believe it. I told him to send me something else and that I was calling you guys.
So in other words, you're telling me that Men's Health is not the ultimate answer to health questions?
I mean, come on,
that magazine knows everything, don't they?
Is there a wager on this bet?
There is. A cup of coffee for me, a beer for my friend.
Well, binge drinking is a big issue. It's not a small issue, and for a variety of reasons. First of all, a number of alcoholics believe they're not alcoholics because they binge drink. In other words, during the weekday, they don't binge drink at all. They may go to their normal job. And on the weekend, they're just, you know, they're plastered from Friday night through Sunday night. And they go, well, I don't have an alcohol problem. I just do that every weekend when I'm off. And the fact is they do have an alcohol problem. If you drink to get drunk, especially on a regular basis, not that occasional basis that occurs, you know, after a major event, but on a regular basis, you certainly are an alcoholic or have a big problem with alcohol.
Yeah, but I don't hear an answer to her question.
Well, there's no definitive answer for killing brain cells. I mean, you know, we have a very interesting issue of saying, well, do the brain cells die? We know that people who are alcoholics and who binge drink on a regular basis 20 years later have problems often with memory loss. So the answer is probably yes. I would definitely fit on the probably yes, because we know that alcoholics are much more likely to have memory disturbances, strokes, and to basically score lower in IQ tests as time goes on. So your friends, your young friends may not notice a difference, but 20 years later, there is a difference.
And awesome, because I'm noticing a difference in them right now.
Well, you notice a difference in them right now. In other words, they're not as bright as they used to be.
They're not as bright at all.
They're not as bright as
and
all.
And one is an engineer, so...
No, that's exact. But getting back to this binge issue, the idea is, well, I'm okay. I only binge drink on the weekend, and I do it every weekend. And so it becomes a very acceptable thing because that's what all your friends do. And the fact is, it's a big problem. It's a problem in college, and it's especially a problem when you're out of college and you continue that behavior. You know, and you're taking the right path by looking at them and noticing that they have a memory loss and not getting a memory loss yourself.
And tell them Zorba says they your friend owes you a cup of coffee.
Yes. Awesome.
Thanks for the call.
Thank you.
Bye-bye. Before we get out of here, Zorba, let's check in on the Zorba Pastor on Your Health inbox. We have a note here from Paul in Milwaukee, Wisconsin. You'll remember not too long ago, we were debating the ulnar nerve, whether it was called the funny bone or the crazy bone.
Yes.
Well, Paul informs us that it is indeed called the funny bone, because the bone the nerve is near is the humerus bone.
Oh, I never thought about that. So it's called the funny bone because it's near the humerus.
Funny
that's
humerus.
Great. Funny humerus.
I never thought of that either.
I love it. That's great. You know, I love these explanations that come from the English experts. You know, here it is. I go to medical school. I get these anatomists who come, and they don't know anything about things like this. It clearly is the funny bone.
Plus, if you want scientific definitive proof, our producer, Adam Friedrich, used to play the board game Operation, which Zorba, I'll bet you used to play as a kid.
Never. Operation.
Don't you
I
know
no
Operation?
Is that like post office?
No. It's a board game, and you have a little thing, and you have to pick the bones off out of the figure in the board without touching this.
Sorry, Tom.
Every doctor should play this game when they're
sorry, Tom.
Anyway, Adam
that
played it.
That was not my game.
Adam played it and had a piece, and the piece in the figure in the board was called the funny bone.
Oh, I see. Well, that's the definitive. That's the definitive answer.
Let us know your thoughts. Just send them in an email to
Zorba@WPR.org.
See you next week, Zorba.
A pleasure to be here, Tom.
If you missed anything during the show or just want to download our recipe podcast, visit us on the web
at ZorbaPastor.org.
Don't forget, you can bug our producer anytime at 800-462-7413. Zorba Pastor on Your Health is a production of Wisconsin Public Radio. It's produced by Adam Friedrich. Brad Kohlberg is our technical director. Charles Monroe Kane is our executive producer. And Gigi Holland fills your recipe requests. Our theme music is by Leo and Ben Sidran. For Zorba Pastor, I'm Tom Clark, hoping you'll join us for the next Zorba Pastor on Your Health.
National support for Zorba Pastor on Your Health comes from the AED Superstore, helping people save lives with Philips HeartStart automated external defibrillators for business, school, travel, and home. Available at AEDSuperstore.com. Copies of today's show are available through the radio store at 800-747-7444. Ask for program number 0411Z.
PRI, Public Radio International.